Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The story you're about to hear is just incredible. And some of you may know a little bit about this story. It's the story of Kim Jong-il, the dictator of North Korea for a number of years. When he was not the dictator, he was involved with cinema in North Korea because he loved the movies and his father loved the movies, and he figured probably the best way to become dictator is to make movies about how wonderful his father was and how wonderful North Korea was. So it's the story of him, but it's also the story of a director, a very famous South Korean director, and his very famous and very beautiful wife, who is an actress. And they got married, and then they were kidnapped in 1978 by Kim Jong-il, who was soon to become the dictator of North Korea. Choi Eun-hee, was kept in a really nice place and given lots of presents every day by Kim Jong-il, and he was in a political prison, and then he got out when he agreed to make propaganda films. So the two of them were making propaganda films for North Korea, and eventually they escaped in 1986, which also is a story. So all of this, and what a story it is found in the just-released book, which is getting all kinds of attention, Kim Jong-il Production, which has been called equal parts history, thriller, and farce. The author's masterful reporting will keep you engrossed until the very end. And the author is with us this hour, Paul Fisher. Paul was born in Saudi Arabia. He was raised in France. He studied in Paris, and he studied at the University of Southern California and New York Film Academy. He's worked as an independent film producer in London for the past 7 years. His first feature film, the documentary Radio Man, won the Grand Jury Prize at the New York City Film Festival and was released to lots of critical and commercial acclaim. He's also written the short film The Body, and he is with us this hour. He's going to be in Milwaukee, actually. It should be a really terrific lecture book signing, too. He'll be at Boswell Books on Monday at 7 o'clock for a talk and a signing of this book. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I don't know. The book just came out, so I don't know if you've had a chance to read it, but you may be familiar with the story and have questions about it. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is @KDunnShow. Hi, Paul.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, Paul, what a story. What an incredible story, Paul. Isn't it?
It is. It's you know, the first few months of research were actually me trying to make sure it was true. That's how incredible it is.
Well, let me ask you then, how did you determine it was true?
Well, there's sort of, you know, essentially the main account of the story is the one of the two protagonists themselves who were kidnapped. So the early process was to take their account, put it on a wall in a very obsessive True Detective kind of style, and then just try and double-check and test every little bit of it and run it against other accounts, any other evidence, and see if there were any weak points.
And would that be Choi Eun-hee's, how do you pronounce her name, Choi Eun-hee?
It's actually Choi Eun-hee. There's something in Korean where the name Choi, which is written Choi, is pronounced Che.
Che.
And then the director's name is Shin Sang-ok, Mr. Shin.
Mm-hmm. So was it her story? Because she kept track of her story, right?
She did. They wrote a memoir together after they left North Korea, which was only published in South Korean, and which is, you know, not unreliable, but it was clearly ghostwritten and sort of vetted by Korean national security experts. So you sort of have to read between the lines of that. So I started from that, from any interviews they'd given. I met Mrs. Che. She's the only one of the pair still alive. Interviewed her several times, ran things by her. Ran things in their accounts by experts in those specific fields, you know, tried to corroborate things with Google Earth images, you know, everything I could think of you know, to see if the story checked out, because it's the kind of story that's, you know, so unbelievable that if there's anything in it that's demonstrably untrue, mm-hmm. it makes everything that is true seem untrue.
Mm-hmm. And it's also such a valuable look, but who else is going to give us a look at the inside of North Korea under the circumstances under which they were there?
That's right. I think, you know, we've all forgotten something I didn't know before I wrote this story was a lot of the things we associate with Kim Jong-il, a lot of the cliches about drinking cognac and the dancing girls and all of that came originally from their account when they escaped and were debriefed by the CIA. And it's sort of become common parlance about North Korean leaders without it being credited to them. So it's sort of going back to the original insider account of living in that regime. And also it sort of shed light on me for something I didn't personally know before I started researching the book, which was the process of the Kim regime's turning North Korea as a state into something that's a performance, something that's an illusion, essentially, using a lot of the tools of cinema and narrative storytelling.
Mm-hmm. And the story before North Korea is even a part of this picture, but the story of Che and Chin is also fascinating because you document the Korean War and who they were as people, how they became involved in theater in South Korea, in cinema, and how they fell in love. That story is compelling as well.
It is. It is. They had never been named by name in any of the early accounts I found of the story when I first came upon it, and it fascinated me that they'd been erased out as people of their own, you know, the crime that they themselves had suffered that had changed their lives. So I really wanted to kind of talk about them in the book and not just about North Korea. And I wasn't familiar with them or their lives or their work before, but they had such an incredible life, you know, even before they were kidnapped in North Korea. You know, a life that equals, you know, great cinema couples in the West and their lives, that equals, you know, Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, or,
yes.
or Orson Welles and Rita Hayworth.
Mm-hmm.
They're that caliber of people in Asia and sort of have been forgotten since.
Mm-hmm. And he was it Shin who was originally from what is now North Korea, a part of North Korea?
That's right. He'd been born in North Korea, went to study as a young man in Japan. And then World War II ended, Korea was divided in two, and he came back to the country to find himself in the South, a foreigner to the place he'd been born, with family who are now from a different nationality across a border he wasn't allowed to go over. And all those contradictions and absurdities of how the Korean situation came to be fascinated me as well.
Mm-hmm. And she came from a relatively poor family and left home at, what, 17?
She did. She left home as a teenager, at the time being an actress for a lot of traditional Korean men, fathers especially, was no better than being a courtesan. And so when she wanted to be an actress, her parents said, no, the right thing to do for you is to get married. We will choose your husband for you. And she wouldn't have it even as a teenager. So she ran away from home and made her own fortune through hard work and persistence.
Mm-hmm. And was she a courtesan for some time?
She wasn't. There were rumors. She was very famous originally in South Korea for those kinds of salacious rumors that went around after the Second World War, after the Korean War, about anyone who, like her, didn't fit into a traditional mold and was a bit of a, you know, a feminist, as we would term it now, someone who wanted to have their own path, who wanted to be a professional woman. And she went through some abuse, and it was only when she met Chin and married him, he was her second husband, that her image rehabilitated itself from a scandalous image that had been imposed onto her.
Mm-hmm. Her first husband was a bad guy.
He was. He was much older, abusive in a way that was tolerated at the time in Korea. And things got worse and worse. As a couple, they were traumatized by the wars. And he was crippled in the Korean War, and his self-esteem and self-image really suffered. And he was an awful husband, and mm-hmm. and they separated when she sued for divorce, which again was an almost unheard of thing
right.
at the time. She was a very brave, you know, single-minded woman.
It is amazing to think of her in her time period, how incredibly strong she was. You said feminist. She really was. When you look at the culture of the country in which she grew up, She must have been shocking to some people. It, just a whole new image of woman.
Absolutely. And she you know, played on that in the film roles that she played. But the career she'd been born in was one where women in her mother's generation would have eaten at a different table from their husbands, would have eaten only leftovers, and where, you know, if you were sexually assaulted as a woman, you were held responsible in almost every situation. And then she came along and ran away from home, you know, followed her dreams. When she was sexually abused by men, she cried foul about it. When she was abused by her husband, she sued him for divorce. When she was married to the most famous film director in the land, she was still more famous than him and made more money than him. You know, she directed films, and she was only the third woman in Korea to do so. And it's something that you still feel in her today. She's 89 years old today, and she's absolutely unbreakable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she is. And there are pictures, they're not in your book, but I've seen them. She was considered perhaps the Asian Marilyn Monroe.
She was. People have compared her to Marilyn Monroe, Elizabeth Taylor. You know, there are articles from the time calling her the most beautiful woman in Asia. And you know, she fashioned clothes. She was a movie star. She was a very, very beautiful woman in her day, very glamorous.
Well, let's move ahead to the kidnapping because we only have so much time, and it's just... And it just makes your jaw drop. It's just an amazing story. But let's go back to North Korea now and talk about Kim Jong-il and what his position was, how he became such a big fan of movies and the movie library he had and how he ever concocted the idea that he was going to kidnap these people to have them make propaganda films for him.
Right.
What a story.
It's incredible, but sort of reflective of North Korea and the way the logic worked, especially in his time as a leader. His father, Kim Il-sung, had been the first leader of North Korea. And Kim Jong-il, as a young man, was, you know, known as a sort of lazy, dandyish, arty type that no one expected to take over. And he'd fallen in love with film at a very young age. It was his passion. As a university student, he actually used his father's Ministry of Culture and the embassies around the world to build a bootlegging system for him so he could see every new film made in the world in his own private archive, which is the collection you were mentioning, which was rumored to be the biggest personal collection of film in the world ever while he was alive. And he had this sort of dilemma. His first job, logically, and the leadership in North Korea was to run the film studios there and run the propaganda ministry, all the films in North Korea, all the books, you know, every bit of culture is state-controlled and state-approved. And his dilemma was that he needed the films to build the cult of personality that we know today, but he also wanted them to be celebrated abroad. And his filmmakers weren't very good because, you know, they decided North Korea would be isolated, so they couldn't bring people in from the outside to teach them, and they couldn't send North Koreans abroad to learn, because that would sort of break the hermit kingdom's isolation. And as someone who had never left the country and whose image of the world and of covert operations had essentially been built from James Bond films and action films, the second he had the opportunity, he kidnapped the two most famous Korean filmmakers he could ambush and brought them over and put them in charge and gave them instructions. This is Shin and Che, gave them instructions to make films that would win awards abroad and make money for the regime.
And he put her up in a pretty lavish kind of setting, gave her presents every day, but he wound up in a prison. How did that happen?
Well, the plan was the same for both of them, that they would stay separate, be put in luxury, and be slowly indoctrinated, enlightened, as the word is. Shin's mistake was he tried to escape twice, and they realized they couldn't keep him in a villa in luxury because he'd keep on trying to escape. So they sent him to a prison, and then when he tried to escape again, they sent him to one of the famous concentration camps where he spent several years, you know, tortured and borderline starved until he, you know, gave in and pretended to be brainwashed and to play along.
And the idea was to use them to make sophisticated films about how wonderful life was in North Korea, to use just as propaganda films, or were they making other kinds of films?
It was to work as propaganda, but, you know, essentially propaganda that was meant to be shown around the world and not just to the people. For instance, Japan had had a very poor image after World War II, and they used film and other arts as a sort of shop window to rehabilitate their country's image, and Kim Jong-il wanted to do much the same thing. North Korea in the late 70s was mostly in the news for, you know, terrorist attacks and plane hijackings and assassination attempts. And while he wanted to go on doing all of those things, he also wanted people to think of the DPRK as a culturally interesting, historically relevant, enlightened country. So the number one goal for him was to use these filmmakers to make films that would win abroad awards, and acclaim abroad outside of North Korea's borders, while sticking to the precepts of domestic propaganda.
And how were they able to move through this? Were their minds changed as a result of all the effort that was put in to change their minds, or did they, in the back of their minds, know who they really were and just to stay alive, make these films, follow his orders?
They knew who they were all along, and they knew that they would have to please him to get enough, you know, free rein to be able to escape. The one thing that changed, you know, which is sort of anecdotal and not intended by the North Koreans, was Shin had no sort of moral conscience in South Korea. He was a very commercial filmmaker. He saw his audiences as masses of faceless, you know, paying customers, essentially. And after being in prison in North Korea, suddenly, you know, he cared more about the social impact that even simple entertainment could have, and he made films in a more mindful, useful way. Which is the only way they changed, really, their outlook on doing their work and on politics.
We're going to be welcoming phone calls, and we'll continue this story. Our phone number, and our guest has been in North Korea as well. It's a country that fascinates us because so few people have been there, and it's very, very hard to understand what's going on in a country that seems totally crazy to us. He is the author of A Kim Jong-il Production. Paul Fisher is a film producer who studied in Paris and in Southern California and also in New York. He has a feature film himself, the documentary Radio Man, and other films as well. And he read everything about this phenomenal story and visited North Korea as well to get a sense of that that place. So we'll talk about his experiences there as well. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. He will be at Boswell Books in Milwaukee for a talk and a signing of his book this coming Monday at 7 o'clock. So you're invited to that. Should be an interesting evening. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Paul Fisher. His book is A Kim Jong-il Production. And we're welcoming phone calls for him, starting with Scott in La Crosse. Hello, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
I'm enjoying this this program a lot. I have kind of a fascination, just in an odd sort of way, with North Korea. I stumbled upon an account of some people who had escaped from prison camps in North Korea, which in and of itself is just amazing, in that according to these accounts, that people can be, if you're thrown into a prison camp, it's some number of generations before your family will get out. In other words, it's like maybe your grandchildren will, and they pick they pick your partners. It's just ooh. But anyhow, so I've read a few accounts, you know, more so recently, and one of these I remember was they said that in the capital Pyongyang, they have, of course, all control and movement. Where you live is all very, very controlled, and supposedly, unless you meet certain physical standards, intelligence standards, standards of attractiveness, you won't be allowed to live in the capital. So I'd like to ask your guests, first of all, is this true? And if it is, isn't this sort of like a bizarre movie set of what a capital is supposed to look like?
It is true, and it is just like a movie set. And thank you for calling and for the question. There's a lot of research, including into North Korean official papers, that indicates that, you know, I don't know about attractiveness, but any disabled people, any mentally ill or challenged people, anyone with any sort of physical or mental impairment or disability is barred from Pyongyang. And even in the countryside, they're sort of ostracized and become something that, in a very medieval way, is still shameful and a burden for the family. And it's very representative of, you know, there is something very medieval about North Korea. We talk about it as a communist state when it's, in fact, a sort of medieval court system where everyone gravitates around a kind of king, emperor, leader, and where there's a lot of superstition and a lot of, you know, the country's isolated and everywhere around it, here there be dragons, here there be terrible things. And exactly what you said about Pyongyang, you know, the title of the book, Kim Jong-il Production, refers not just to the films, but also to the idea that North Korea as a state, as a performance, is something that the Kim regime has, you know, written and directs every day, and they give their people roles to play, and Pyongyang is, you know, the set piece in that performance. And it was built to give off an impression. It was very deliberately mapped out beyond the issue of disability. Unless you're in the top ranking of North Korea's caste system, you're not allowed to go into Pyongyang ever. When I visited, we left Pyongyang for a bit, came back, and the North Koreans with me were the ones inspected on the way back in, who had to show their residence permit on the way back in, not me.
Goodness.
And you know, it. I've described it as, it feels like Disney World, you know, before it opens to send in Pyongyang. Everything looks fake, everything looks empty. It's very, very quiet. You know, and it's built to give off an impression, but it feels very fake. There's fantastic stories of diplomats, you know, being shown around Pyongyang, and the North Koreans are trying to impress onto them that it's a very busy, bustling city, and look at all the people going in and out of the metro, and the diplomats stand and watch the scene for 20, 25 minutes and realize it's the same 50 people going in the metro, out the metro, in the metro, out the metro. And the same people queuing at shops, and, you know, it's all designed to cover up the reality of you know, as Scott mentioned, the prison camps and the torture and this, you know, racially based, you know, almost, you know, eugenistic society.
Anything else? Go ahead, Scott.
If I just, as a follow-up, how do you have any projection, any feel for how all this might develop or fall apart? I mean, that, I don't know, I'm assuming this little family can't keep control of this forever. Do you get a sense that at some point it's going to all implode, or what do you think might happen?
I actually don't think it will implode, because I don't think anyone benefits from it imploding. The flip side of the situation of that is the reason it's not really changing is no one in the outside world really has any, you know, gets any gain from it changing. South Korea doesn't want to pay for reunification. China doesn't want to lose that sort of buffer with Japan. Japan doesn't want to deal with those issues. The U.S. and Russia don't want to deal with those issues. And, you know, it sort of depends on the regime. It's finally come to the point where Kim Jong-un is admitting that his people can't eat and that there's a food shortage and all these things that 10 years ago would have been anathema for a Kim to admit. And they'll have to figure out how they open up and how they, you know, maybe normalize the way China did a long time ago. And it very much depends on how quickly and how well the Kim regime is open to doing that. Mm. It's a very hard, you know, state to predict. No, thank you for calling and for the questions.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. Thanks very much. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Weren't you just a little bit fearful, being a filmmaker yourself, that they may kidnap you when you visited?
I wasn't really. I don't think they kidnap people anymore.
Oh, they don't.
No, it was a very Kim Jong-il thing, and they did it a lot then. And I told them I was a filmmaker up front, so they'd pay attention to me filming things, mm-hmm. and they wouldn't to me writing things down. Hmm. Which worked very well.
Mm-hmm. And talking about productions, there's a great scene in the book where Che is talking about being invited to, is it his birthday party, Kim Jong-il's birthday party, or just a regular,
yeah.
It's the birthday party where, you need to describe this for us, because the event was, you know, the naked dancers who have to be a certain height, and the military uniforms. I mean, it was just, I could just see it in my mind's eye, and it was out of a Fellini film or something.
Very much so. Those were actually weekly parties that, you know, they had a purpose. Kim Jong-il was rising through the ranks, and he was looking to establish a circle of people he could trust or not. And he did it through these parties, through socializing. And the parties happened weekly, and they were very debauched and bizarre, and he believed that, you know, you could tell whether a man could be trusted based on how much he could hold his drink. So everybody got very drunk, and he believed in having something he called the Joy Brigade, which were technically in the bodyguard class of the army, but who were, you know, teenage girls, girls barely out of their teens, that he'd personally picked from schools around the country for being the most attractive young girls, young women in the country, whose career then became to dance for him or massage him and the people at the party who performed sexual services at the parties. And they all had to be shorter than he was, which was, you know, a tall order, no pun intended, because he was pretty short himself. And they were all retired at 21, 22, because that was considered too old. And he had a band, and he had bizarre games where he sort of, you know, instructed. He would shout out army uniforms, and everybody has to put on army uniforms. They were hiding under the table and run around in circles. And they, you know, pinatas with presents in them that he'd shoot at with a gun. And it all sounds very absurd and sort of Peter Sellers meets Fellini, as you said. But it was a way for him to, you know, put people in absurd situations and see who he could trust, see who he could lean on, see who would break, see who would contradict him.
Wow. Bill is next in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call. Just a quick comment by way of a footnote to a previous comment. And referring to some of these aspects of North Korean society that people in the West pretty uniformly deplore, applying the term medieval to that as a sort of trope for barbarism and all the things that are bad in a society is, I think, questionable and in some ways kind of offensive. The Middle Ages in Europe were, in many respects, a very high civilization and one to which we're deeply indebted in many ways, and had aspects we don't happen to like anymore. But I just question the conventional use of that as a trope for badness.
Well, if he was comparing it to a medieval court system, would you not agree with that characterization, Bill?
No, I think that's true. But it was in the whole context was about how kind of creepy and horrible this North Korean society is at the present time.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole tone was negative. It was, of course, a court system.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And had many glories, which most people would be prepared to celebrate.
Mm-hmm. Paul?
I mean, I used the word medieval to allude to, you know, the hierarchy, the system of power, you know, the superstition, the way certain courts put themselves in opposition to others. You know, I'm not especially sensitive to the idea that anything that we say might be a bit too derogatory to the regime, because it's always addressed to the regime. I was always very, very aware of writing the book, and it's a big part of the book that, you know, for all we talk about the parties and the films and everything, you know, at the end of the day, there are 23 million people within those borders who were, you know, abused and imprisoned and taken advantage of every day. So, you know, I mean, I don't think using the word in that sense, you know, offends anyone in the Kim regime, anyone who's a North Korean, or, you know, anyone from the Middle Ages who's still around listening, really.
Yeah. There aren't many, I'm sure. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Tell me about the other prisoners that Che encounters when she's being held in this sort of luxury the home. Who else has been kidnapped? Who else is being held?
She met specifically a woman from Jordan and a woman from Macau in China that she grew, you know, varyingly close with. One of the things that really surprised me when I started looking into this is how widespread kidnapping as a tool was for the North Koreans, for the North Korean regime, for a decade or so. And in the compound Madame Che lived in, there were other houses and there were other women and other people coming in and out of those houses and sort of wandering around and not really communicating. And it turns out that there's very, very strong evidence that between the mid-70s and the mid-80s, North Korean operatives essentially kidnapped anyone they saw fit, anyone they had an ability to, for various reasons. A lot of innocent people who just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. But it was as widespread as to, you know, they kidnapped and honey-trapped and ambushed, you know, people from Japan, South Korea, Lebanon, Italy, France.
Goodness.
And people used to talk about it as a sort of boogeyman story, and no one really did anything about it. Until very, very recently, when the Japanese government pushed it as an issue, and the North Korean government admitted to, you know, I think, kidnapping a few people.
And why were they being kidnapped? How were they targeted?
The vast majority of people just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. There was a shortage in North Korean spy schools, as absurd as that term sounds, a shortage in North Korean spy schools of genuine natives. For instance, genuine Japanese citizens who could teach North Korean spies, this is how the Japanese behave, this is the slang, and so on. And the best recruitment technique that Kim Jong-il could think of was to just send operatives to find random Japanese people who might be wandering on the beach at the end of a summer day on a walk by themselves, put a bag over their heads, and bring them back to Pyongyang and put them in charge of teaching spies. That was the vast majority of them. And then there were women who, you know, were brought back to be married off as trophies, to be given as rewards to Pyongyang-based terrorists. You know, but for a lot of these people, it was very much a random thing. There were children and teenagers who were kidnapped because they happened to just be by themselves and North Korean operatives were around. You know, very tragically so, just disappeared off the face of the earth.
And it would be very hard to trace. You in the book talk about Shin, who's trying to find Shay because she's disappeared, and he's a little bit worried about her after a while. And, you know, how are you going to find out? He eventually does tell us the story of how he does find out. But if you're kidnapped by the North Koreans, how's anybody to know where the heck you are?
Exactly. He had an instinct early on that she might have been kidnapped by the North Koreans. There was some evidence suggesting it was an option. And it's fascinating to me. It was a reflection of that time that it came to his mind that she might have been kidnapped by the North Koreans. It was sort of a rumor thing, but still no one took it seriously in that case. What happened very briefly is Shin went to Hong Kong, where Che had been kidnapped or disappeared from, as far as he knew, to investigate himself because he didn't trust his own government, which was a very common thing in Korea at the time. And while he suspected that the North Koreans might have done it, while there was some evidence that the North Koreans might have done it, the official investigation was very cursory and, you know, essentially made him the suspect number one because they just divorced. He had money problems. And you know, just didn't believe even as an option that the North Koreans might have done it. Until, of course, he disappeared as well and then up in Pyongyang as well.
Mm-hmm. How did you get into North Korea? You said you told them you were a filmmaker. Did they know that this book was coming out?
No, I don't think they would have let me in if they had.
I don't either.
They accept tourists. There's, you know, 500, 600 tourists that go to North Korea a year. I told them I was a filmmaker so I could be shown more of the filmmaking locations and so on. And it's a bit of a dilemma when you choose to do it because, you know, to be there for a week or two costs a few thousand dollars. It's overpriced. You're aware that the money goes to support the regime, even if it's not a, you know, huge amount of money. But for me, you know, it would have felt dishonest to write about a place without going. And even though, you know, they give you the two guides who stay with you 24/7 or like any time you're outside of your hotel room to keep an eye on you, and even though it's all very choreographed, the fact that it's choreographed and the way that it's choreographed and the way everybody behaves, to me at least, was hugely informative of you know, the mindset and culture that's been built there.
Yeah, I'm sure you have to see it to really believe it. That's true of a lot of places, but I would imagine it's very true of North Korea.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of subtleties, you know, things, as Bill was saying, that you could, you know, make a caricature out of, that just standing in Pyongyang for several days, suddenly, you know, certain connections or logical things come up. And you know, of course, they haven't really built anything new in a while. So I was able to see the film studios the way they were, and I was able to buy maps and just get an idea of the geography, which is always very helpful and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's get to the story of escape. When was it that Che and Shin thought that they might be able to get out of the country? How did they, and then we have to talk about the CIA and how they became involved in this. They were allowed to go, was it to Italy, or where were they going?
They were allowed to go, once they were reunited and started work, they were allowed to go, you know, essentially anywhere east of the Iron Curtain. The dilemma for Kim Jong-il is having kidnapped them, and now that he was going to make it public that they were working for him, he didn't want the world to think they had been forced to work for him. So he wanted to give the illusion that they were free. So he started sending them to location shoots abroad and film festivals abroad, you know, always with, you know, anywhere from 3 to 20 highly trained bodyguards who would stay with them all the time, stay in their hotel suites, take their passports the second they landed. And their plan over the 3 years they made films for Kim was, if we please him with every new film, if we get more ambitious with every new film, at some point he will need to send us a bit further west, and he'll relax his guard a little bit, and we'll just seize that opportunity. And that's exactly what they did eventually. They were given an opportunity to go to Vienna, which was neutral, which was as far west as they would ever go, and to go together. Usually they were sort of kept separate, so one of them, if they escaped, would leave the other one behind. And when that trip came along, they made a plan, and they pounced on it, and then took the opportunity to escape.
Did anybody in the world know where they were?
There were rumors by that point, because they'd been made to come out and give a press conference claiming that they'd voluntarily gone to North Korea. And at the same time, papers and a tape recording of Kim Jong-il, in which Kim Jong-il admitted to kidnapping them, that they had made in secret, they had smuggled that out in the hope they could use it as insurance in case something happened to them. And the friend of theirs who was holding on to that stuff panicked and released it to the media. So over, you know, a few months in 1984, you know, suddenly they came out and gave a press conference saying they were voluntarily in North Korea, and then all this material came out that said they had been kidnapped in North Korea. And to anyone who paid attention, it just seemed like a very confusing, you know, battle of, do we trust the South Korean government, which at the time was a dictatorship itself, or do we trust, you know, this press conference we're seeing? So people knew they were in North Korea, but didn't really have any idea of the real story.
And they wound up getting debriefed by the CIA in Virginia. How did that happen?
The tape recordings they had of Kim Jong-il and the information they had about Kim Jong-il was very valuable. And so the South Korean CIA and the American CIA sort of fought over who would be allowed to debrief them. And Shin and Che personally chose the United States because they were fearful that in South Korea, where there was still a national security law that forbade anybody from consorting with the North Koreans, that if they went back to South Korea, it would actually become, you know, a criminal offense that they had made films for Kim. So they chose to work with the Americans, and they were debriefed in Germany first to assert that everything they said was true or verifiable. And the trade-off was that they would get asylum and protection, and they ended up really needing that protection. There were death threats from the North Koreans very quickly after their escape, to the point that they lived in Virginia because it was near Langley, and they lived there for 2-3 years with live-in CIA bodyguards, and probably would have stayed, you know, in that protection program longer if they hadn't insisted on going to Hollywood and trying to start their careers again.
A story. We're going to welcome more phone calls. I know many of you haven't had a chance to read the book yet, but if you have questions about North Korea or about this phenomenal story, we certainly welcome them. Paul Fisher is our guest. His book, just out this month, A Kim Jong-il Production, and it's about Kim Jong-il kidnapping two South Korean, very prominent in the world of film, a famous director, and his beautiful and very famous wife and actress, and forcing them to make films in North Korea that would be good for the state. And the story goes on. And you can't believe that it's true, but it's true. And the actress is still alive in her late 80s. So join us. Did I give you the number? 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. And we do want to remind you that Paul, if you find this story fascinating, and I'm sure many of you do, is going to be at Boswell Books in Milwaukee to sign his book and to speak. And this is coming up on Monday, this coming Monday at 7 o'clock. You can go to boswell.indie, I-N-D-I-E, bound, altogether.com for more information. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're speaking with the author of the Kim Jong-il production this hour of our program, and welcoming calls if you'd like to call, 800-486-8655. Paul, the New York Times review of your book, and you're getting a lot of great press on this, says that though your book takes place more than 30 years ago, the story sheds light on the recent blow-up surrounding the Sony film The Interview. Do you think it does? It sheds this book sheds light on that, and if so, how?
It does to a degree. I think, you know, the story in the book speaks to how important film and storytelling and, you know, in this case, comedy, you know, being made fun of is in North Korean politics. And I think, you know, the culture that was built throughout the years that were talked about in the books is when they married cinematic storytelling to a religious cult of personality. And I certainly feel like I understood what happened over the last few months with Sony and the hacking and with The Interview a lot better for having looked into that time period in North Korean history than if I just watched the news without, you know, learning about, you know, the fact that they've built a culture out of storytelling and film and telling people that what they see in films is relevant and true. You know, and of course then comes along an American film that makes fun of their leader in a way that to the Kim regime is blasphemy and breaks every taboo. You know, of course, that's something they would be more offended than maybe in the West we find logical.
Right. And yet that's they're being offended, and yet they're kidnapping people to make their films, you know? Whoa, something's wrong with this picture.
Exactly. That's the absurdity of the regime, really. You know, like any bully, they're oversensitive about everything.
Right. And tell me about the whether or not the films that they made and Kim Jong-il's interest in film and his big library and using film as propaganda secured his place as his father's favorite and as future dictator.
That's right. Essentially, for Kim Jong-il, the films were a way to prove to his father that he would, you know, protect and promote his legacy. And most of the films he made as propaganda, you know, celebrated his father as this heroic demigod. And that's what his father wanted. You know, he wanted someone who, when he died, would protect his legacy, you know, not go against him the way maybe Mao Zedong's, you know, and Stalin's successors had gone against them. And you know, not just the films, but the visual images we associate with North Korea, the big portraits, the statues, the whole cult of personality is something that Kim Jong-il created to make his father feel that his legacy would be safe in his hands.
And what about the films that were made? Tell me about the subject matter. Tell me about their artistic merit.
Well, they were the best films ever made in North Korea, which doesn't necessarily say very much. But they really broke with tradition. North Korean films had really been in a mold up to that point of propaganda about domestic affairs with foreign bad guys, you know, very didactic. And Shin and Che, you know, they made a couple of films like that, but they also made, you know, a monster Godzilla-style film. They made a kung fu film. They were allowed to film scenes abroad. So when they showed their films, it was actually the first time North Korean audiences had seen, you know, the streets of anywhere abroad. And in a small way realized that it wasn't the chaotic underworld that the Kim regime had told them it was. And you know, they made a musical, they made films where they had romantic leads falling in love with one another, when in North Korean film up until that point, love was an emotion reserved for the leaders and the party and the cause. Hmm. You know, they, in a literal sense, they stuck to the propaganda rules, but in a lot of very small subversive ways, you know, they not only made films that were better than any North Korean film until then, but they made films that completely opened up a world to their audiences, is the feeling I get.
Can you still see those films somewhere today?
You can. The Godzilla one, which is called Pulgasari, is on YouTube in full, and it's a fantastically bad film. And you know, it's about a monster created by peasants to overthrow their tyrannical, profit-hungry landlord. And it, you know, it's really badly made, and it was very expensive for North Korea, and they flew in the guy who was in the actual Godzilla suit, and the Japanese Godzilla crew lied to them, told them they were coming to make a Chinese film and then kept them in North Korea to make this film.
Oh, my gosh.
That's on YouTube. And a lot of the other ones are available on bootleg DVDs that you have to buy, unfortunately. But that one's online.
And whatever happened, Shin, there's another whole story here which is also fascinating. Shin winds up falling in love earlier than this story with another woman who's in his films, and they have two children together because Che can't have children, and then they all wind up in Hollywood together where this young woman is coming over to visit, and whatever happened to that relationship? Whatever happened to the young actress?
It fizzled out. It was, you know, there's something that's almost like Dallas in their family history, very soap operatic, where, you know, Shin and Che were married, they were famous. Che couldn't have children, so they adopted two children. Shin said he didn't care, but then he turned out to have had two kids with a young starlet. So he and Che got divorced. He lost his filmmaking license, looked to move outside of South Korea. He didn't really have any interest in staying with his mistress at all, so sort of left her behind. And then he and Che got kidnapped, fell back in love, which is something that really never would have happened if they hadn't been kidnapped. Got remarried and then ended up in, you know, in Virginia with live-in American CIA agents having barbecues.
Right, of course.
with, you know, their two adopted children, Shin's two children from the starlet, who by this point had a very serious drug and alcohol problem and had sort of given up custody, but every now and then would come over and try and pull them away again. You know, all the human, very relatable, messy, funny, heartbreaking things in the story beyond the kidnapping, you know, they're also larger than life as well. And, you know, kind of an old Hollywood, gossipy, dramatic, fantastic life.
Yeah. Well, I'll bet you never in your life thought that you were going to embark on this book or learn about this story, did you?
No, I didn't. It was completely unexpected. I stumbled upon it, started looking into it, and then it became, you know, kind of the gift that keeps on giving for me. And I was very grateful and fortunate to be able to tell it. It, you know, I'm really pleased for it. And then, you know, in another way, it's one of the themes in the book is I was, you know, by virtue of, you know, luck, providence, being born where I was, doing what I was able to tell the story. And there are 23 million people who, by virtue of where they are born, are part of the story, and
yes,
you know, Che and so on. And so, you know, that sort of a lottery or providence or, you know, plan, however you believe it to be, that puts you in a situation where you can either live this story or, you know, for me, completely get surprised by it and spend years obsessed with it was something that fascinated me.
Mm. Well, and it's getting terrific reviews, so you must be very happy about that.
Very lucky so far, yeah. We're very, very lucky. And you know, it was a labor of love and of caring for the people involved. And it's my first book. I've never written an article or review before. So that people are, you know, enjoying it, taking something from it, is hugely gratifying and humbling.
I'm sure. Well, Paul, thank you so much. Have you ever been to Milwaukee before?
I haven't. I'll be there for a couple of days next week. It's my first time.
Great.
Yeah, I can't wait to explore.
Well, you'll love Boswell. It's a wonderful bookstore, and the people are great. And
that's what I've heard.
Yeah, and I'm sure that people will love to hear more about the story. Thank you so much for being with us. It's just an incredible story. I can't imagine coming across a story as sensational as this, but it's true. Ever again, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Paul Fisher, the book is a Kim Jong-il production. And as we said, he's going to be at Boswell this coming Monday to talk about his book, to do a signing. It's at 7 o'clock, and that'll be a lot of fun because those events always are. And what else can I say about it? Oh, I should tell you, in case you're just tuning us in, Paul is a filmmaker as well, and he has won awards for his work. He is from... Well, he studied in Paris, and he also studied in Southern California and New York. And his first feature film, the documentary Radio Man, which won the Grand Jury Prize at the New York City Film Festival. Thanks very much to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour. And thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll next be with you on President's Day. And don't forget, today's Abraham Lincoln's birthday. President's Day on Monday, where we'll talk about, you know how they do these surveys of all these big historians to find out who are the greatest presidents of all time. So we're going to do that on Monday, President's Day. Seems fitting. And invite you to think about that over the weekend and call in with your thoughtful response on Monday. News is coming up. Thanks very much.